War News Radio at Swarthmore College. I'm Allison Raybar.
And I'm Jay Clayton.
Saudi Arabian-led airstrikes destroyed one of Yemen's last operational airports this Tuesday, removing one of the country's few entry points for international aid. However, Saudi Arabia's ongoing air campaign has been unable to stop the advancement of Shiite rebels, who recently captured the southern port city of Aden on Wednesday. The same day rebels took control of the city, King Salman of Saudi Arabia named Interior Minister Prince Mohammed bin Nayef as his successor, replacing Crown Prince Mukrin bin Abdulaziz. This move has been interpreted by many as a move away from the legacy of his predecessor, King Abdullah, who passed away this January.
The Iranian Navy forcibly diverted a cargo ship on Tuesday as it traveled through the Strait of Hormuz, a passage used to transport much of the world's oil. Iran accused the Maersk Tigris of traveling in territorial waters, outside the bounds designated for regional shipping. Although Iranian reports initially stated that it was a U.S. vessel, a spokesperson from the Pentagon confirmed that it flew Marshall Islands flags. American officials' quick clarification was considered an effort to smooth potential backlash on the delicate relations surrounding the Iranian nuclear agreement.
The Nigerian army has freed 200 girls and 93 women from Boko Haram camps in the Nambisa forest in northeastern Nigeria. The rescued women and girls include no one from the group of over 219 schoolgirls captured in Chibok last year. The abduction of the Chibok girls garnered enormous international attention, but was far from the only event of its kind perpetrated by Boko Haram that year. According to a report by Amnesty International, Boko Haram has kidnapped nearly 2,000 people since 2014. Working with a coalition of neighboring countries, Nigerian forces have made large advances into territory previously held by Boko Haram during the past few months. Meanwhile, the whereabouts of the Chibok girls, and so many others who have gone missing under the reign of Boko Haram, remain unknown.
Zambia's United Nations peacekeeping troops are expected to be sent into the Central African Republic this week, part of a larger effort to mitigate a humanitarian crisis. Conflict in the CAR has led to over 900,000 displaced people, with the UNHCR reporting that over 2.7 million people, or 60% of its population, are in need of aid. Funding for the CAR has been low, at only 14% for internal programs and 9% for programs to help neighboring countries that may be harboring refugees. UN Humanitarian Coordinator Claire Bourgeois warned that the situation was on the verge of becoming, quote, a forgotten crisis. But the history of international intervention in the CAR remains mixed. In 2013, France sent an additional 1,200 soldiers into the country in response to a request from the interim government, which was facing sectarian conflict. A recent UN aid worker revealed, however, that French soldiers had sexually abused homeless children while stationed in the CAR, some as young as 9 years old. Anders Kompass, the aid worker who released this report to French authorities, has since been suspended by the United Nations.
United States military airstrikes and special operations missions continue in Afghanistan, largely targeting low and mid-level Taliban commanders. These operations are described as part of the training and advisory parameters established by the U.S. after the official combat mission was ended last December. While most U.S. officials maintain that Taliban forces are only being targeted when they directly target U.S. forces, others, such as General John Campbell, the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, openly acknowledge that U.S. troops will target any Taliban action that threatens American, NATO, or Afghan security forces. In the wake of recent gains by the Taliban, including the launch of a spring offensive targeting provincial Afghan government buildings and a U.S. military base, the stated goals of continued U.S. military presence seem highly flexible. One anonymous military official told reporters, quote, "They are putting guys on the ground in places to justify the airstrikes."
The United States Supreme Court heard arguments this week on the use of the drug midazolam in executions by lethal injection. The case relates to a botched execution of an Oklahoman death row prisoner last year. Witnesses said that the prisoner, Clayton Lockett, appeared to moan and struggle before he was eventually killed. Four Oklahoma inmates challenged their upcoming executions under the same protocol, but in January the court refused to stay the execution of Charles Warner, who was later executed. The court later agreed to hear the remaining three inmates' case. Midazolam has only recently been used by a few states as part of the lethal injection cocktail, replacing an earlier drug, sodium thiopental, which is no longer available for executions. States have had difficulties obtaining lethal injection drugs as producers, many located in Europe, have refused to sell their drugs to prisons that administer the death penalty. A decision is expected to be reached by the end of June. Until the decision is reached, the executions of the three Oklahoman death row inmates will remain on hold.
Peaceful demonstrations and riots broke out in Baltimore on Monday, following the funeral for Freddie Gray, a black man who died after suffering severe spinal injuries while in police custody. Maryland Governor Larry Hogan declared a state of emergency, called in the National Guard, and instituted a 10 p.m. curfew for the city. Similar to the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner, Freddie Gray's death has set off national conversations about police brutality towards black Americans, a conversation many in poverty-stricken Baltimore say has been a long time coming. The mainstream media has also been criticized for their coverage of the protests and violence. In an interview with CNN's Wolf Blitzer, community organizer and activist DeRay McKesson criticized Blitzer for emphasizing property damage above what he believes is the real issue, human lives.
Obviously, we don't want anybody hurt, but I just want to hear there should be peaceful protests, not violent protests, in the tradition of Dr. Martin Luther King.
There should be peaceful protests, and I don't have to condone it to understand it, right? That the pain that people feel is real, and you are making a comparison. You are suggesting this idea that broken windows are worse than broken spines, right? And what we know to be true is that the police are killing people everywhere. They're killing people here. Six police officers were involved in the killing of Freddie Gray, and we're looking for justice there. And that's real, right? That, like, the violence that the police have been inflicting on communities of color has been sustained and deep.
Findings from the police investigation of Mr. Gray's death are expected to be released later this week.
In response to Saturday's earthquake, Nepali students of Swarthmore organized a candlelight vigil on Wednesday night to honor the lives lost in the disaster. War News Radio reporter Catherine Kwok had a chance to speak to two student organizers, Sabrina Singh and Rajneesh Yadav. Here's their story.
I was trying to go to bed at 2, and then I was like, let's check Facebook, like, what's going on? And then I read about this. I experienced earthquake 2 years back when I was in Nepal, but it was like only 5-point-something magnitude. It was not dangerous. So I was like, okay, again, it should be the same. Then I wrote to my brother, and what he writes is, like, everything is destroyed. Like, somehow his phone was working. There was no electricity. It was very difficult for me. I didn't know what to do. And then I tried to contact my friends, my family. Nobody was replying.
Like Rajneesh, I think the sense of helplessness I'm feeling because I'm away from home is just one of the hardest things to deal with right now. I remember, like, 2 days ago, I was, like, Skyping with a few of my friends. And as we were on Skype, a couple of us were in the United States and a couple of us were back home in Nepal. And as we were Skyping, there was another aftershock of, like, 4.6 magnitude or something. So they started, like, shouting and screaming, and they obviously had to run away from the Skype call. So the Skype was on, and I could hear people in the streets just shouting and running. And here we were, like, 3 or 4 of us in the United States, just glued to the screen, and we're fine, we don't have to run. And all our friends on the other side of the Skype call is, like, running. So that sense of kind of, I'm there, but I'm not there, has been very paralyzing, and I feel helpless.
Rajneesh Yadav and Sabrina Singh, both students at Swarthmore College, experienced the earthquake miles away from their homes, families, and friends. Singh says she has confirmed that her immediate family members, who reside on the outskirts of Kathmandu, are safe. However, she pointed out that the capital is facing major issues with water shortage and high risk of disease outbreaks. Yadav, who is also from outside of Kathmandu, said his family is safe as well, and destruction near his home was not as severe as the mountainous areas.
Two of my friends are from the places where the epicenter is, and, like, I talked to them today, and they tell me that, like, all the houses, like, 100% of the houses are destroyed. Like, people have gone crazy, like, they don't know what to do, and they don't have the food and the relief material. Like, most of the relief materials which international organizations are sending, they're, like, stuck at the airport, and then you have to go to, I don't know, like, customs and lots of different stuff. So it is not reaching, like, the places where it should be. And, like, people in the valley, like, it's because the capital city, and, you know, like, people have money, so they're doing, like, better in terms of, you know, like, living and, like, eating.
The biggest sort of devastation, the biggest problem is outside of Kathmandu Valley, where the roads are bad as it is, and the earthquake made it even worse. So it's harder to even reach those areas and even collect data on how many people died and how much property destruction has happened. So you really see sort of like an urban-rural divide in this conflict case, where the urban area, the capital, is devastated, but relatively less so than the rural areas where you don't even have information, you don't even have communication, and you don't have a correct sense of what the extent of damage is.
Singh also noted the clear divide in access to resources between people of different socioeconomic classes. The people who are already economically disadvantaged to begin with were the biggest victims in the earthquake, yet they are also those with the least access to relief and material support.
From the sense that I get from just reading newspaper articles, reading articles about the Haiti earthquake and how the relief there was distributed, and also people on the ground who are witnessing this firsthand, the immediate thing to do seems to be to really help the small scale and local people who are actually doing the work, who are mobilizing volunteers from within Kathmandu and trying to go outside of Kathmandu and deliver like food and water and tents to people outside.
Singh and Yadav, along with a group of Nepali and international students at Swarthmore, have begun 4 initiatives in response to the earthquake. They have started campaigning on Indiegogo, an online fundraising site to support local NGOs and people who are doing relief work on the ground. The group is looking to aid organizations and volunteers who are providing help to districts outside of Kathmandu.
And the reason why we decided to focus on sort of local people rather than international NGOs is because, like Rajneesh mentioned, a lot of the aid that's sent is backlogged in the airport because our airport isn't big enough, but also that people already on the ground have a much better idea of, you know, the geography, how to get to places, how to prioritize which needs are the most salient and things like that. So we thought, you know, giving to the local people is our number one priority.
In addition to online fundraising, Singh and Yadav are organizing a clothes drive for earthquake victims. Multiple collection bins have been placed around campus this week. According to Singh, all donated clothes will be sent to a local organization in 2 or 3 months' time.
And the third thing that we're doing is a vigil, which happened tonight, where Swarthmore students and faculty and staff of Swarthmore can come together and sort of hear our stories and also show their support and solidarity and learn about how an event, you know, thousands of miles away is also sort of felt in this campus.
According to Yadav, since the money from the group's online fundraiser will take around 3 weeks to reach Nepal, they have placed donation boxes in places like the Science Center Coffee Bar and the Colbert Cafe. He said he hopes to collect cash as soon as possible and send them back to Nepal in the coming 2 or 3 days. As the school year is coming to a close, many students will be heading home. Both Singh and Yadav said they are looking forward to returning to Nepal for the first time after the earthquake.
I'll be going home for the fall, and I just got a job there. I'm very thankful that I have a chance to go home and to actually see things as they are being rebuilt. Hopefully I can sort of still be in touch with Swarthmore and communities outside of Nepal, because I think the relief is one thing, which is short term, but I think the reconstruction effort will really begin after a few months for the long term, for the development of Nepal's infrastructure and economy and things like that. And that's, I think, the really key thing to watch out for, because after Haiti's earthquake, you know, the international aid and foreign aid that poured in really hurt rather than helped Haiti. And it was more for the international agencies' benefits rather than Haitian people's benefits. So I think it's very crucial for me to go back home after a few months, because I do want to have a first-hand account and also a critical lens towards sort of foreign aid that will come into my home after a few months.
I'm also going home at the end of May, like after I'm done with my finals. I just can't wait to like be there, you know. Most of my friends who are in the States are going back, and then we're already like planning to go to these places and then volunteer, help, like raise money, like do what we can to help the people.
As Nepal heads towards its 6th day after the earthquake's onset, the death toll continues to rise. Since search and rescue operations remain a priority, many cultural heritage sites have been left in unguarded ruins. As Singh and Yadav had pointed out, many victims of the earthquake are not receiving any support despite the efforts of aid groups. As more and more images of devastated villages and homes surface, one can only imagine the great effort that will be needed in the reconstruction of Nepal.
You just listened to a piece from War News Radio reporter Catherine Kwok. Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Leo Elliott, John Gagnon, Evan Grannon, Catherine Kwok, Sabrina Merrill, Joe Millman, and Amber Sheth. I'm Allison Raybar.
And I'm Jay Clayton. Until next time, thanks for listening.